And we are live. It's Value After Hours. I'm Tobias Carlyle, joined as always by Jake Taylor and our recurring special guest, Alex Morris, the science
aren't they
of
special
hitting.
Anymore, right? If you
not so special.
It wasn't special not the so first special, time, but yes. Thanks for having me, guys.
Welcome, Alex.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
I watch a lot of this housing crash porn on YouTube, and there's this one particular guy that I like, and he always starts every single thing off. He says, big moves in the US housing market. So I'm going to start that. Big moves in the stock market.
Smash
big news.
That subscribe button.
nothing really. No really big moves. Modest moves. But some interesting stuff going on. Berkshire ruined everybody's weekend by Buffett putting out the shortest letter he's written in a long time, I would say.
Yeah, what was he padding it with podcast notes about Charlie? And
yeah, bought himself 2 pages with that little ploy.
By the way, what was he talking about there? Was that just the Daily Journal and he called it a podcast? Or was there something I missed?
I think somebody said he did something with Patrick Collison. Is that his name?
Oh, did that come out yet? I knew that it was... I knew that it was been recorded, but okay.
Yeah, I tried to find. I think that's what it was from. That's what someone said, at least.
All right, I'll go look for that later. That's good to know.
Yeah, I had a few people ask me, but I didn't know. Someone said the Pinker podcast, but I don't know what that was. let me give some shout outs because there's some good spots here. Kingston, Jamaica, Saskatchewan. I hope I'm saying that right. Cardiff, Wales, Amsterdam. What's up? Saskatchewan. Thank you. Spelling it out for me.
This is like a geography quiz.
Beaverton, Oregon, Prince George, BC, Hamburg, Germany. All right. Canada, very funny. Carlsbad, Norberg, Sweden. What's up? El Dorado Hills. Is that Eldo Hills?
Whoa.
California. Dubai. What's up, Samson?
My backyard. EDH repping. I like it.
Brisneyland, up early. Good job. Mexico, nice. Altamonte Springs, Florida. That's a good spread. Vermilion, that's a good name. South Dakota.
Were any of the bullet points in Buffett letter about Charlie's mention of crypto shit, or did that not get called out?
Yeah.
I didn't see that one.
Yeah.
I didn't either.
He said it enough times at DJCO. I'm surprised he missed it.
Yeah, that was funny.
It was interesting.
I mean, what's the point of having billions of dollars and being 99 years old if you can't give people your pure, unvarnished opinion on everything?
Yeah. well, maybe Buffett was, he subtweeted a little bit there with, don't bail away in a sinking boat if you can swim to one that is seaworthy.
Yeah. Energy's devoted to changing ships. You said that before, right? Energy's devoted to changing boats.
I'm being glib. I'm sorry, crypto bros.
You're being glib. I know that everybody wants an update on the value spread. The data came in for January, or Alpha Architect put the data up a little bit late. It looks like January closed a little bit. So if you had a nice run in January, might have been value getting a little bit cheap, value spread closing, which was nice.
Did you feel that, Toby? I don't know.
I did. I can tell you what happened in February. It's gone the other direction.
Okay. Good to know. Back to wide open, full spreads again.
I want two closing months in a row so I can feel it when I read the fact that it's closed, but I already knew it. I'm sure it's blowing out again.
Imagine a whole quarter worth. Could you even?
I don't know. I think the longest run that I've seen was October to February. So that was October 10 to February 2nd, not to be too specific, but you know, that was a nice little run there.
That was when you were just drunk on power. Like, oh,
this feels pretty good. I said to my wife, I feel pretty good. It must be, we must be having some good performance out there. Value spread must be closing. I can sense it.
The force is strong.
Finger on the pulse. So Alex, you've been doing some work on HD. What do you
Home Depot for the layman.
Home Depot, sorry. For the layman. What's the view on Home Depot for the economy, the market? What are we looking at here?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the the best way to sum the story is as we were talking about before we hopped on, if you go back to, call it pre-pandemic, it's a business with no unit growth, or effectively no unit growth.
And so no new stores is what that means.
No new stores. It's a crazy story. It's a really interesting story. From early 90s to mid 2000s, stores went from 200 to 2000, basically, or 2200, completely put the brakes on in 07, 08. And people were skittish, as you might expect, 10 times earnings, something like that. And it's been an absolute monster over the last 15 years. I mean, even before the pandemic, they really focused on running the core business well, and it shows in some of their comparative results with Lowe's and other players.
Operating leverage is so amazing to see play out, right? When you drive revenue through the same four walls,
yeah,
at such a better clip, it just so much hits the bottom line. It's amazing.
There must be some reason for they've just decided that whatever it is, 2,200 stores, is that what you said? Is that saturation? They've decided that's enough. They're close enough to everybody to they don't need any more stores.
Yeah. So in the 07-08 period, as they kind of looked at where they were at, they actually had I think the number is $500 million of kind of stores in the pipeline. I think this is before things got really, really bad, but I think they had $500 million of stores in the pipeline. They essentially just took a write off on and said, we're not going to build these. And the days of us just, and some of it was international, in terms of where they were looking to grow, at least in the early 2000s. But I think they just realized, let's focus on kind of what's happening inside the four walls. And then obviously the, e-com and distribution stuff around all of that. And it's proven to work quite well in terms of the unit economics. So it was a, call it a mid-single digit grower in the years leading up to the pandemic. You have everything that's happened subsequently, past 3 years, revenue growth CAGR has been, I think, 13%. So obviously well above the trend. You have this interesting dynamic where, the primary driver hasn't been transactions. It's actually only grown low single digits from Q4 19 to Q4 22. The driver's been ticket. And it's tough to parse out exactly the percentage contribution from these buckets, but it's pretty clear from their how they report the numbers and what they've said previously that early on a big driver was kind of what you would call real or organic ticket growth from mix shift to more pro customer spend more than anything else, which is driving up the number of dollars in a basket and really speaks to remodeling and home investments and the like and in 20, 21, 22, as you've gotten to the later part of that period, it's been a lot more of COGS inflation and the like. So now where they're at today, you're seeing where customers were a little bit more willing to eat some of those price increases and still, not impact volumes as much as that price was hitting them. It's now kind of leveled out with one another. And they're pretty clearly saying, hey, customers are becoming a lot more sensitive than they were previously. I think they wrapped up kind of the macro data pretty well with a comment where they said, home prices from pre-pandemic to June 22, I want to say, they said home prices increased by 45%. And subsequently in the past X number of months, they've declined by roughly 3% cumulatively on whatever data they're looking at. So I think it just speaks to the nature of, what has happened. And then there's also, obviously with rates and everything else, I saw in a recent Wall Street Journal article, NAR said home affordability is at its lowest level since 1985. So I think there's just a big question about what the trend looks like for this business in 23, 24 and beyond. They're guiding to comps basically flat, which is worse than what they've been reporting, but certainly doesn't strike me as being particularly pessimistic. Yeah. I was listening to the FND call before we hopped on Floor and Decor, and one of the analysts asked during the Q&A, which I liked a lot, how long is this going to last and how severe is it going to be? So it was a good question. Unfortunately, they didn't have the answer either. So
I was waiting for the answer.
They didn't have the answer. Unfortunately, they didn't have the answer either, but it was a good try.
Alex, do you have a sense of what drives, is it more like, okay, I'm trying to imagine turnover of houses, I would think then people come in, they want to make it their own. They spend money at Home Depot. Or is it my house price went up. I have home equity now. I take money out and I do stuff to it. Like, which is the, what drives more, do you think? Turnover or home equity HELOCs, basically?
Yeah, I think it's both. I mean, I think it also depends probably as you look at specific category. I mean, I've seen something recently, for example, you know, hey, when the economy does a little more poorly or when home prices come in a little bit, it doesn't necessarily lead to all that work just going away, but it might be, you know, that kitchen or bathroom is now going to be
good enough paint for job another couple in a room years.
Or, yeah. It might be a smaller project in the house that is, you know, not going to stretch you too much on the amount of work or hiring someone or, you know, the budget, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it partly depends on who you're talking about in this space. You know, it's funny, if you look back in 06, 07, 08, 09, I think that's right. HD comps were down every year during that period, cumulative comps down more than 20%. The mix between the two was essentially split between ticket and transactions. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I obviously that period was very unique. I don't know if this is going to be anything like that, but
Toby says it will be worse.
Yeah. Well, if it is, then that's problem for, I was talking with Bill about this. I was talking about even prices coming back 10% after a massive run. Does even that impact the way that people will think about it, given just, you know, indexing their mind to what it's worth at some, you know, crazy high potentially? I would argue it probably does, at least on the margin, but we'll see.
Yeah, the data that I've seen says, I thought May 22 was the peak in the house, but it could have been June or May, same difference. And I think it Zillow, I've looked at Zillow's home price data, and I've looked at the Alfred or whoever produces, there's a luxury home. There's a few different series that they produce. I think it comes out of the Edgar, or I'm just forgetting where it comes from, but they've both had, the peak was May or June after running up unusually quickly at the very tail end of what had been a pretty good run already. And then it's come back off. I think it was like 4.4%, not seasonally adjusted, but this is also a softer time of the year. So seasonally adjusted, it ends up being like 2, which I think rhymes with, I think you said 3%, right? That they saw back.
Yeah, that's what they said.
They're just saying somewhere in the middle of those two numbers.
Yeah.
The stuff that I see is people just going back and looking, because it's so slow. It takes, typically the housing market takes years and years to bottom. Like 5 years or 6 years, it seems, looking at the last two in particular. And so the last one was 2006, 7, 8. And the bottom actually wasn't until 2012, although there were two. There was a bottom in like 2010, and there was another bottom in 2012. It kind of got up off the mat a little bit, and then it fell back down. And the true bottom was 2012, but it was comparable to the 2010 bottom. And they look at the various... one of the big... The reason that people say it's different this time, they say lending standards were stricter, but they've also gummed up the it's been harder to evict people from their homes, harder to go through the foreclosure process. So that's part of the reason why inventory is so low. But as that eases, they think that there's going to be a lot of inventory coming on the market through foreclosure. And that will probably coincide with, so you know, that Michael Cantro has that HOPE, hope, housing is the first thing to go, unemployment is the last. And so the statistic that I saw today is that employment is currently ticking, unemployment is ticking up faster than it was after Lehman. It's only just sort of started. It's still at pretty low levels, but it looks like it's rocketing up. I think all of that, to me, it just looks like that if we've got a problem with house prices, house unaffordability, the simplest way to resolve that is lower house prices. I don't think it's particularly controversial at all. It's sticky and it takes a long time for it to work through. And so over the next 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years, I think you see it, but I think it's well and truly underway now. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I mean, I just can't work into it any other way. If prices go up 45 and cost to borrow goes up significantly and your all-in cost goes up, whatever, 60-70%. I just don't see how the math works for someone who hasn't already bought. And, you know, Home Depot and these other guys like to say, hey, 90% of homeowners now either own their house outright or have a long-term fixed rate mortgage that's sub, I think, 5%. But again, that's, you can't move them.
Yeah.
If yeah. that's the condition, I mean, I don't know. It just seems, it seems very tough on both sides of the coin to me. But I think, you know, I was talking to Bill today about this, about companies talking about shipping costs and supply chain, et cetera, et cetera. As Buffett likes to say, you know, you can't always point to like one thing in macro stuff, because there's always the, you know, like the and what question, and then what happens after that question. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, in this case, it looks like it's partly getting resolved from the fact that demand is potentially coming in quite significantly, at least in certain categories. And that is now at least partially starting to fix the problem. At least if you listen to someone like Floor and Decor, they're talking about, you know, passing price in the other direction now back to consumers as their cost to serve is starting to come in. So
JT, what's your topic today? What do you got on deck? We got to go through the Buffett letter and a few other things.
Yeah, it's all just Berkshire related. After so much stuff came out this last weekend, I feel like it's, you know, it'd be very on brand for us to dig into the Berkshire.
Let's get in that. Oh, Hank, we got an Aussie chinning from Moscow, Russia. That's cool.
Hopefully, has his freedom still. Well, where do you want to start? You want to start with the Buffett letter?
Yeah, let's do that.
All right. Well, for me, I think kind of on the shorter end, right? Like we said already, maybe a little skimpy on details. Although a couple interesting things I saw. Boy, spent $1.3 billion on Coca-Cola. And by the way, buying from 1987 to 1994, like accumulating over and over and over, right, for years on end, that in and of itself is kind of an amazing thing. But currently, dividends of $700 million in 2022 from that. He's on a 54% yield to cost right now, which is just staggering, right? And the value of the investment now is around $25 billion. So just the price alone, he's on an 11% CAGR for 28 years. That doesn't even count the dividend. So what an unbelievable investment. And American Express looks kind of similar, like $1.3 billion accumulated over, you know, reasonable amount of time, finishing in 1995. Now $300 million a year that he's getting, which is a 23% dividend yield on his original cost. And also similar 11% price CAGR for 27 years for American Express. I mean, what an amazing, just two home runs, right?
I wrote about this somewhat recently. I think the whole Coca-Cola thing is so fascinating with the, so one start, as you said, you know, starts accumulating late 80s, finishes the buying in 94. If you go back and look at the price, what he paid in whatever years those were, 87, 88, 89, the price he paid in 94 was three times higher. And he was still willing. I mean, and we all
know. How hard is that to do intellectually?
I don't know. I've never done it before. Exactly. So I guess very hard. But yeah, then completely stopped, hasn't bought or sold his share since 94. And you think about, obviously, the crazy run up in the price throughout the late 90s.
Yeah.
A lot of management problems.
50 times earnings in by 98. And then he pulls the Gen Re switcheroo. Yeah. To lower the exposure to it effectively. What a bold move that was.
Yeah. And you know, even fast forwarding to today, you know, I guess he didn't disclose it now in terms of the value relative to the equity book. Obviously you can back into it, but it's 5-7% of the book. Just a fascinating story in my mind, in terms of willingness to actually be an investor / holder of the business, not tinkering along the way on a position that was greater than 30% of the equity book through much of that period. But then also the cash flow dynamics of Berkshire and how that kind of influences the whole thought process around these things, which obviously may differ from how an individual thinks about it. It's all very interesting.
Yeah. Maybe might be good to get into some of the 10K and talk about Geico and what you've been seeing there, Alex.
Yeah, I think the simplest way to frame it, I think, is if you go back 5 years, I wrote down some numbers just so I have them. 5 years ago, 2017, Geico had 16.3 million auto PIFs, policies in force. Fast forward 10 to 22, 17.2 million, so call it 900,000 net. Progressive, end of 17, 11.7 million. 2022, 17.9 million, 6.2 million net. So 6.2 versus 900, obviously that's just volume. You have the, you know, obviously the cost of running the business. Last 5 years, Geico underwriting expenses, 14% of earned premiums, progressive 21%, you know, slightly different model. Mm-hmm. But when you look at loss and loss adjustment expense ratio, Geico's been at 82% of earned premiums, Progressive's been at 72, and 22 is also a big divergence here in terms of where they're both at. I think you go back and listen to, and I'm far from an expert on this stuff and trying to learn more. You go back and listen to what they were saying about telematics and UBI when it started getting discussed in that 12, 13, 14, 15 period. And it was kind of, you know, Buffett specifically said in 13, I invite you to come back and compare the results in 2 to 3 years. And it didn't take 2 to 3 years, but a decade later, the results are in and it's not looking too hot. And they've changed their tune, but, you know, I think some have rightly picked up on the fact that it's not something you can turn on overnight, I don't think. And there may be more to this story than just telematics and UBI, but I think it's pretty, I mean, they've said it such that they just missed it. And I've wondered too about this, and I'm curious your guys' thoughts. Do you think Buffett being out there and talking about decisions at a subsidiary or own company of Berkshire is, he can't totally avoid it. I get it. Do you think it impacts their willingness to think about doing something like this more seriously back in 13, 14, 15?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think he's close enough with some of these that he talks about where he's in on the conversations. And so, you know, I would imagine that that wasn't just his opinion. Like that's sort of like what they talked about and arrived at.
Like the party line.
Yeah.
Everybody's on the same page.
Right. But yeah, I mean, this last year, I mean, you could kind of call it a disaster for Geico. I mean, it was $1.9 billion loss, 105 combined ratio, mostly due to used car price inflation and property and physical damage claim inflation. Premiums written were up 2%, but that came from 11% price increase, basically premium price increase, minus 8.9% in policies in force. So I was kind of wondering if they are they pulling back the reins a little bit? Because they've decreased underwriting expense 16%, and most of that is ad spend, right? So Geico's ad spend is being backed off, which says maybe he doesn't like the pricing in general right now relative to the cost, which might be a little bit of a tell of what he thinks about inflation potentially. I don't know. I might be reading into that too much, but if he doesn't think he's getting enough premium to make up for the risk that they're taking, even on short term, right? Because auto insurance is a very short tailed insurance, right? It turns over 6 to 12 months. You get a new pricing chance. So I don't know. Maybe that's saying that it's not as hard enough of a pricing market for them to want to really be like plowing into it with ad spend. I don't know. What do you guys make of that?
The telematics is the plug into the car that tells you.
Yeah. It's like an accelerometer basically that theoretically correlates with some risk. If you're driving erratically, there's going to be more, it'll show up on the telematics.
Do you think it influences your behavior? If you have that little thing in the car, you see that you're like, oh, better drive a little bit more carefully.
I bet it does.
I mean, that alone is worth having.
Interesting update on this point. So I was reading Progressive's letter today. They just reported results this morning. So they introduced Snapshot in 2010, which is their little telematics offering. Geico released their version of this in 2019. What they said in the 22 letter that I thought was interesting is, to your point, this was previously an offering where you had it for one policy period, I guess 6 months. And at that point, the rate was set based on that. They could adjust higher or lower over time. They kind of changed the implementation of it. What they're doing now in 22 and 23 is it's a continuous use, and you'll get adjustment to your policy rate at each renewal. Mm-hmm. And what they showed in their deck from this quarter, which is interesting, for the people that I think they baselined it on a renewal rate for the business or retention rate for the business, for people who were getting a significant discount or a moderate discount, the retention rate was 300, 500, 700 bips above kind of the core business. For people who they came back to and said, hey, we're going to add incrementally to your cost, they had a minus 16% relative to the baseline. But that just means the person's leaving as they give them the appropriate rate, and then they're going somewhere else.
Where they're not keeping track of how crazy a driver you are.
Yeah. They're like, yeah, we're going to charge you the appropriate rate, and now you're leaving. And you look at Geico, and loss in LAE in 22 was 92% of earned premiums. At Progressive personal lines, it was 78 or 79%. I mean, they have they're certainly better on underwriting expenses, but they have a loss in LAE problem relative to, you know, their clearest competitor in direct.
When did Buffett pick up Geico, the first chunk?
Oh, gosh. Well, what he bought in the 70s, did he keep that through or did he sell that portion? I think he kept that and that grew into the 50%, and then they bought the other 50 in 95.
That would be what I would say as well, but that would be a low confidence.
I just wonder if that was that type of insurance, just it's hard to make money through highly inflationary periods.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing that Progressive talked about in their letter, which speaks to what you were saying, JT, is they took pricing in 22 and it's in 21. Sorry, I think they said high single digits. It sounds like they saw some impact in terms of customer ads early in the year. And they ultimately took pricing again in 22 of, I think, 9%. And what they kind of indicated is that the rest of the industry was late to take pricing and they saw volumes kind of improve at the close of 22. It sounds like they feel, and their numbers would be supportive of this view, that they're a little bit more in touch with what they need to be doing on the underwriting side than some of their peers.
They had a few good years too through when nobody was driving during COVID, right?
Yeah. I mean, combined ratios were way down with that, but then they gave some of it back in kind of a make the customer feel better that the fact that they paid so much premium and didn't drive at all.
Yeah. What else you got, JT?
Let's switch gears to the railroad. And so revenue coming in at $25 billion last year, which is up 12%. Sounds good. Operating costs up 21%, and their fuel costs were up 65%, which that's not so good. But they have surcharges they can put on there. They still ended up with a 34% operating margin, which is amazing. But here's the thing. Revenue per average car, plus 19%. Car volumes down almost 6%. So this is that same story of Home Depot that Alex was just telling, is that we're getting price increases, but we're getting volume decreases. And boy, like, one, does that say that are we in a recession already? If you have, you know, like kind of using BNSF as a proxy for the US economy, like things moving around, maybe not the worst pulse that you could take. And to me also, you know, prices up 19% and volumes down 6%. That's what stagflation looks like, I think. So I'd be curious to see, you know, how this kind of continues. I think we may find that maybe we're already in, you know, worse shape than the other economic data that's slower to report than necessarily this keyhole into the U.S. economy, which a railroad might represent.
Yeah, that's not a cheery thought. But I think it lines up with just about everything else that I see anyway. I'm somewhat pessimistic about the economy in general and housing, everything at the moment. It all makes me a little bit nervous, honestly. I'm surprised it hasn't shown up in real estate or housing prices yet. I can't really square those two. I guess we're down like 6 or 7% over the last 12 months. It's not much.
Yeah, I haven't looked closely at BNSF. I think it's kind of the point you're just making, Toby. I think it's a company like Target to me is interesting because it's obviously pretty easy to understand. And you look at pre-pandemic to now and sale, it's kind of like the Home Depot story. Sales are up very significantly. The difference there is, well, one, their mix of business, they're much less of a kind of, you know, grocery store food retailer in the same way that, you know, Walmart is, for example. They're really a grocer more than anything else. Target plays a lot more in these discretionary kind of general merchandise categories. And it's funny, they're not seeing, at least so far from the numbers I've seen, you're not really seeing the hit to them in terms of the revenue side of the business. It's not coming in very significantly, again, at least so far. But in terms of the profitability, they are, I mean, they're talking about taking 3 years to get back to mid-single digit EBIT margins they reported pre-pandemic, where, you know, they peaked out at 8.5% 2 years ago. And they were guiding to either 6% or 8% in 22, and they came in at 3.5%. So it's a business, obviously, where if you get caught off sides on cost slash, you know, revenue assumptions, you can see real pressure on profitability in the short term on top of, you know, potentially significant excess inventory that you're holding. So it just strikes me as one where it's oddly persistent in terms of the challenges that they're facing. And I don't know what the read through from that is, but it just strikes me as odd that this is not, it's not really settled, even though they knew what their problem was 6+ months ago. Now it just seems odd. And I would say the HD guide and the FND guide also seem odd to me. And I don't totally understand.
Well, I mean, that dynamic that you just described, it kind of describes the entire S&P 500 right now. I mean, it's all margins seem to be coming in. They peaked at 13.3%, I think, in 21, which was like off the charts, like 2x the long run average, on their way south right now. And that's, you know, if you think a PE, where are we now, like 19 or something, if that E is on its way down, which it just seems like all the micro measurements show that the E is on the way down, that P needs to adjust as well to get to a reasonable valuation. So I don't know, not to be too bearish, but there's some concerning elements right now.
The difficulty is when you're analyzing to take the macro into the micro, and you're analyzing individual stocks, you look at all of these things that have been overearning for a little while. I mean, it's hard to tell if something's overearning or if it's just growing very quick. It's very, very hard to tell the difference between the two. And so I look at these things that look cheap on the last 5 years of comps, and like, that's just a nightmare to kind of figure out through the last 5 years. Like, what is the average earning power? What's the real earning power through the last 5 years? It's good 5 years now includes 18, 19, 20, 21, I guess 20, a little bit of 23. It's tough. That makes me want to pay a lower price, honestly.
One would think that you would want to be conservative with that margin of safety of what you'd be willing to pay with such erratic predictability, huh?
Yeah, and it's not even. I mean, it is erratic. It's very volatile. It's sort of artificially volatile, but it's also just figuring out what the true earning power is. It's just hard to kind of figure it out through that. I don't know. Yeah. It's going to be an interesting. I think it's an interesting 10 months on deck, 8 months on deck. I think we're drawing pretty close to the precipice one way or the other. We find out one way or the other pretty quickly here.
I think an interesting flip side to some of these companies, you know, generally more established, profitable, you know, just figuring out what P&L looks like in the short term, is some of the unprofitable, you know, call them product market fit companies that don't know if they have a business yet. Might be a fair way to describe some of them. And thinking about, you know, in some cases what they're communicating, in other cases what they're communicating and, you know, actually starting to deliver against, and, you know, what that means for the changes and what their businesses may potentially look like in a handful of years. I mean, Airbnb is a very notable example where they, you know, they've had significant tailwinds there in terms of the shift in travel to some extent, especially early on in COVID. And they've also benefited from, you know, higher kind of room night rates. So that's certainly impacted their income statement in a significant way. But one example there is they spent a lot of money on performance advertising in the pre-pandemic days. And when the pandemic happened and they turned off their spend, you know, not to get too hyperbolic, but they realized that a lot of their spend was just wasted money. And so what they've done from 19 to 22 is they took sales and marketing from 35% of sales to 20% of sales. And, you know, they're at record volume. So it's just interesting to think companies that will potentially test some of the assumptions that the market maybe didn't force them to test themselves on previously. And now you're going to see what happens in some of these cases. I'm sure some will be quite bad.
It reminds me a little bit of that Restoration Hardware tweet that was doing the rounds about their ad spend on Google, where they said they went and looked at the 1300 words that they were using on Google, and they found that the 22 that accounted for the most, like 90% of the clicks or 80% of the clicks, was like misspellings of Restoration Hardware. So they switched off all the others, including the Restoration Hardware misspellings. And I tested it as soon as I read that. I just mangled Restoration Hardware. It still comes up. It's like the top link. The only difference is there's no shaded box over the top with Restoration Hardware. I shouldn't see anybody else trying to steal that space either. So I guess that's the risk that you have when you're in a highly competitive market, that you get, and I've done that before, not knowing, typed in the name of the the retailer or whatever, and then click the link above, not realizing that it wasn't to them, it was to a competitor. So that's a real risk.
Tough thing I just don't know which half of the ad spend's being wasted.
Yeah. Classic.
I typed in, this is very anecdotal, but I typed in Google Flights yesterday and the top ad result said Google Flights on it and then slash Priceline, and it was a link to Priceline.
Wow.
I was like, oh, wow, that's pretty it's pretty sneaky.
I think that's what I did. I saw the word that I was looking for in there and, you know, not thinking, just clicked it and then realized I was in the wrong place.
But I guess Google's fine with it, so that works.
Yeah, but if enough people kind of get that lesson, I wonder what happens to Google. I wonder if they see a little bit of softness through this period too. Like, they have been insulated from the cyclicality of advertising for the most part, just because they've been growing so fast and stealing from other channels.
Offline, yeah.
Probably going to see this time. They probably reach that saturation point where the cyclicality turns up.
I thought they would stop growing at insane rates. And I think it was 2013 or 2014, the first time I looked, and they've ticked off like 20% quarterly growth, like a clock every quarter since then.
This is done. The cat's out of the bag.
It's not growing any bigger.
10 years later.
They didn't do it for two quarters. And then the quarter after that, they grew 70% or something. So,
what a beast.
Yeah. So the day I buy it, it'll stop.
Then it'll roll over. It's done.
Naturally. That's the only reason that's the only way it'll get cheap enough.
So I could give you some more numbers here. BH Energy, which is, God, what a amazing business this is. Like, the ability to just eat capital, almost infinite capital that they want to feed into it and produce a 10-ish percent regulatory return. Care to take a guess as to what the effective tax rate of BH Energy is? Remember,
because there's
a lot
so
of
much
credits.
Depreciation.
There's negative 25.
There's accelerated depreciation, and you have all the tax credits for the wind and solar.
Yeah, that's tough. It's pure speculation. I'll say 10%.
Negative 25.
Negative 52%.
What?
Ooh.
So net income is like 150% of EBIT, basically.
All the housing bros out there just decided they're going to become EBIT. Energy infrastructure bros.
Oh my gosh. Amazing. So MSR, actually, so this is manufacturing services, retail, and then they also put their financial products in there now as well. It's kind of the basket catch-all for everything that's not railroad, insurance, or BH Energy. That actually had a pretty good year in 2022. Like, it had been sucking wind a little bit relative to the other components of Berkshire. But this last year, there was some bounce back, and a lot of that is attributed to Precision Cast Parts, which was a big component of that. They had a plus 16% revenue growth, which is good news for them. Clayton continues to be an absolute home run for Berkshire, 21% revenue growth last year. Unit sales plus 6%, the rest of it in price. So, but fourth quarter for Clayton, unit sales were down 4%. So already like seeing slowdowns there. And that same story they said is playing out at Forest River, which is the RVs stuff, apparel, which is, a bunch of Hanes, Brooks, all those things, Dexter shoes.
And then, Fruit of the Loom.
Yeah. And then Duracell as well, that they own. All those are expecting slowdowns or already feeling it in unit volumes. And they said that they're actively right sizing those businesses already. So, I mean, they're kind of telegraphing that there's a lot of places that are, they're taking in the horns a little bit, it feels like. So, yeah, it's interesting.
Is it surprising at all, do you think? Like, we've had some over-earning years here for a while. I don't think that it's necessarily, just cooling off a little bit back to, whatever the underlying sort of population growth or GDP growth, whatever the underlying trend is in there. Is that surprising, do you think? Wouldn't you just expect that we've front-end loaded a whole lot of stuff over the last few years, and now we just sort of go back to trend, which might mean falling for a little bit. It's funny that the market seems to, like, the stock market is like this accelerometer on that stuff. If it goes up a little bit faster than it expects, the stock market goes crazy up, and then you slow down just a little bit, goes crazy down on the other side, although we haven't seen it go down on the other side for a little while. I guess 2020,
it does feel like it's the derivative of velocity, right?
Yeah. What else you got, JT?
Let's see. I mean, just think about $470 billion worth of equity in the company now, almost 948 billion of total assets on the books. Just amazing. Just the size of that is staggering.
How big was Apple? Do you have it in front of you?
What is Apple, like 115 or something? I think I might be a little off on that, but it's down from where it was, obviously about 25%, $37 billion cash flow from operations. That's not too shabby. I mean, just the law of the way the compounding works out after all these years, it's like we're in that phase where every single double now just leads to just insane amounts of money. Only spent $8 billion on buybacks after being more like 25 to 27 the 2 years before that. And some of that is, you know, price to book right now is at 1.4-ish but you could make the argument that price to book is increasingly irrelevant for Berkshire just because of the way the operating businesses are working. And also book value is shrinking as you do buybacks, right? So there's, I would say that the number that price to book should be evaluated should be going probably a little bit higher, and probably actually like earning power was greatly increased this last year. Cause you actually had the decrease from the marking down, you know, Apple as a big chunk, like that reduced book value by quite a bit. So, and they actually decreased their cash by a kind of a surprising amount. There's not quite as much cash on the books. You had the $11 billion purchase of Allegheny, which was part of it. Another $15 billion of CapEx, you know, which they're always spending more than depreciation. But in general, they're sort of structured right now. Like I look at their balance sheet and I look at for like kind of what's Buffett's asset allocation look like. And it's 25% is cash and short-term investments, 5% is bonds, which is probably mostly related to insurance operations, and then about 70% equity. So, you know, that's gives you a rough sense of how Buffett's looking at the world. Now their use of debt is masterful. That's something that I think that's really missed in when you look at the capital allocation of Berkshire. Right now, I think the average is around the 3%, and it's all long dated fixed. Some of it, you know, the Japanese stuff, the yen is like zero forever, free money basically.
Who took the other side of that trade?
I don't know, some banks and you know he actually
Japanese insurers.
He executed it like when the yen was especially weak. So it was very like his dollars translated, you know, into like he just knows how to play this game so well. It's just amazing to watch a master at work. But they've got, you know, let's say, what is it? 76 billion at the railroad in debt, 46 at railroad and energy. So and that's actually sort of regulatory required, like the insurance or the commissions that they operate under want them to have debt to lower the cost of capital that they are then paying on for when they figure out how much to pay, like a return on equity for them. So they want them to have some debt because it lowers the cost of capital for these companies. But then the insurance side of things, they've got and corporate level, they've got 46 billion. And then, which something else you don't really talk about much is the deferred tax liability is $77 billion. So you could think about that as like an interest-free, no expiration, non-callable loan from the U.S. government of $77 billion that they're running with. So, I mean, Buffett continues to be a master. Like, there's nobody better doing it. I just marvel at his the artistry of it.
Yeah, I like the float comment 2011, 2012, hey, it probably won't grow from here. Could fall 2-3% a year, whatever it was. And yeah, it's doubled since then.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't hurt. They added another how much did they get? Like maybe $20 billion, I think, can float from the Allegheny transaction. So there's some of that's inorganic, but still counts, still float.
Yeah.
AIG and now imagine taking those bonds and converting, like, because they can probably free up a fair amount of capital now because Berkshire's so overcapitalized that now Allegheny doesn't have to have as much tied up in 3% bonds or something. And now they could make that into equities more. So imagine what that float's worth all of a sudden.
I like the little section that he had. We discussed a little bit earlier, the secret sauce where he was talking about buying Coca-Cola, $1.3 billion cost, and then this year, $700 million in dividends. But then he had this nice line, assume for a moment I'd made a similarly sized investment mistake in the 1990s, one that flatlined and simply retained its $1.3 billion value in 2022, like a high-grade 30-year bond. That disappointing investment would now represent an insignificant 0.3% of Berkshire's net worth and would be delivering to us an unchanged $80 million or so of annual income. Still, wouldn't be a bad outcome. But you just don't get those extreme outcomes that he's managed to get. I mean, I think he said he's only made one good decision every 5 years, right? But it looks like that's enough.
I feel like that's a little bit of a...
Yeah, he's selling himself short, but...
Yeah.
The point stands that he gets one of these absolute blockbuster hits every 5 years, and that's enough. I mean, if he'd just done C's and then just plowed everything back into SPY or something like that, he'd still be Warren Buffett. He'd still be well known.
Yeah. I was looking at Geico, even with the problems it's had. You look back over the past 25 years since they kind of retained control, and just on underwriting, I mean, I think they paid 2.3 for the other 50% that they didn't already own. In the first 50, they paid some nominal amount of money. I mean,
$50 million or something.
They paid for the repurchases in theory, but they paid a nominal amount for that stake. And past 25 years, the pre-tax underwriting gain's been $20 billion. And, and it's still an ongoing business, obviously. Hopefully one day to be profitable again.
Right. I saw that Berkshire earned more interest on their $110 billion of whatever you want to kind of call cash there, than they paid in interest expense for their $116 billion of debt that they're using to help, have a bigger balance sheet. So what a legend.
He had this comment on inflation, which I can't find it right now. Do you remember what he said about inflation? He had a little shot on buybacks and a little shot on inflation.
He's against it.
He's not in favor. Yeah. I ain't for it. I'm against it.
Well, let's see. He said that Berkshire offers some modest protection from runaway inflation.
That was all he said.
But this attribute is far from perfect, and huge and entrenched fiscal deficits have consequences.
Yeah. He said that he didn't know about the. He didn't know the consequences of the. He and Charlie didn't know the consequences of those giant fiscal deficits.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry, I just can't find it. I just thought it was interesting. He teased it out. He said, what was it, $25 trillion in tax revenue and like $43.9 trillion in spending. So he doesn't know what the consequences of that differential are, but there will be some at some point.
Yeah, 11.6 trillion cumulative deficit over the last 10 years. I was surprised, actually. So, and I guess I knew this, but I just had forgotten. But, the government receipt intake there, 48% from individual income tax. Social Security is 34%, and only 8.5% for corporate income tax. That, I don't know if that's like kind of long run sustainable to me. Like, I know it was higher before. Obviously, we had the tax, the Trump tax cut in 2017 or whatever it was that brought it down from 35 to 21. But if I'm sort of like game theorying this out as far as like what will society allow for corporations to earn without taxing them before like you get the pitchforks out, I think there's a real risk there that corporate taxes go higher from where they are today. And therefore you should also be paying a lower multiple if you think that that's going to be pinching it at some point. Like, corporations have kind of won over the last, especially the last 5 years since that cut, but we're doing a lot of money printing and without taxing the corporations. I don't know. I mean, there's all kinds of arguments about it, like trickling down, and there's a lot of and then what to be answered, as you said, Alex. But
does it get captured in the dividend payment? Like, you pay tax at the corporate level, then you pay a dividend, then you gets paid again in the hands of the person who receives it.
How much of the earnings of a corporation, like what's the dividend payout of earnings right now?
It's 1.7%, I think.
Well, that's the yield. That's not the how much they're earning, right?
Proportion is paid out.
Yeah, the dividend payout as a percentage of earnings is.
I think it's not quite half. It's like 40%.
Yeah. So if it's 1.7 on a 5% yield, it'd be what, mid 30s payout ratio, something like that. You said 20 times before around there.
Yeah. So there's a lot of retained earnings that aren't counted in that aren't being taxed. And so
they are now with the buybacks.
Yeah. Well, so that was where I was going.
Yeah. Exactly.
So we got the thin edge of the wedge last year with 1%. And now we're going to what, 4%? And eventually, I guess it just equalizes with dividends.
Huh.
Yeah, Buffett had a good line on that about,
yeah.
about if you're listening to, let's just do the direct quote. When you're told that all repurchases are harmful to shareholders or to the country, or particularly beneficial to CEOs, you're listening to either an economic illiterate or a silver-tongued demagogue, characters that are not mutually exclusive.
Yeah, it's a good line.
Yeah,
it's a good line.
John Bartel's got a question. Any guesses on the 12 investments that moved the needle for Berkshire that Buffett referenced in the letter? Apple, Sees, AMX, Cap Cities.
I don't know. I think Monish did a post on that on Twitter, if you want to go look at his version.
I think National Indemnity would count if we're talking wholly owned businesses.
Berkshire itself.
Yeah. I don't know. I'd have to think about that.
General Re's got to be on there for the dilution that it created for saving. When you trade 3x book value for your equity for something, and by the way, that equity value highly, highly bloated because of paying huge multiples on the underlying equities inside of it. So you had very expensive stocks pushing up a book value, and then the price to the book value was also at three times, and then he was able to wash that out in a transaction tax-free with the acquisition of General Re. I mean, that was massive. Like, I think Chris Bloomstein says that Berkshire would be worth half as much today if that hadn't happened.
Wow. Yeah, that was one. I didn't understand that until you described it, that Bloomstein had explained it to you. That was good insight.
Yeah.
Now we just got to find the next thing. Warren.
What's next?
Time to acquire Paramount.
Well, they've still been buying Paramount, haven't they?
I think so. How big is the stake? Is it? I mean, the company's not that large, so.
Why do you think I saw Oxy's upped its buyback again and is paying, increased its dividend as well, so it's doing well there. Why do they do things like? They've taken like TSMC, spat that back out again. Any thoughts on that?
I don't know. I think that's the lieutenants who are maybe a little bit more active in their management of things.
Yeah, I noticed it on Ally, which I own. They owned 2 million shares, whatever it was, 200 million shares, whatever the number is. And they sold 5% of it. I was just thinking, I wonder what leads to that decision. It's a situation where there's, You probably believe one thing or the other on a name. Like, you'd probably either want to keep owning it or be out is how I think you'd probably think about it. Just struck me as odd that the decision was to sell 5%.
Yeah.
But they're smart guys, so I'm sure there's some thought process behind it, but it was confusing for me.
Just rebalancing, I guess. You could just be, just don't like the risk reward at that level and take it down a little bit. I don't know. Maybe you plan to sell it out as it goes up.
Yeah,
I mean,
maybe Charlie found something good, and they're getting ready to lever the entire organization for one big trade.
YOLO.
Yeah, it's his. They have a Charles Schwab account with margin in it that they're gonna take.
Buffett gets his YOLO trade at 98 or 99.
Yeah,
lever up the account 2x.
I've got one more little tidbit for all the. For the real junkies for Berkshire, which I hadn't seen before. And one of my friends ferreted this out, who just finds the most random ass stuff, but he found like International Dairy Queen's operating results from last year. I'd never seen this before. And it was in some random ass like trade magazine. So financials, this is actually for 2021, but I'm sure it looks similar for 2022. But so as you know, like, DQ does a franchising model where they charge only 4% of revenue, which is actually very low in the franchising world. But on book value of $106 million, their their revenue was $224 million and operating income of $112 million. So its operating margins of 50%. And cash flow from operations is $113 million. So it's like almost direct. If it's operating income, it falls to cash flow. CapEx of $2 million, right? So like almost nothing. Dividends back to Berkshire of $110 million. So basically nice. Just this thing is just printing money and sending it to Omaha every single year. Like ROEs are, through the roof, over 100% plus every year. But this is just basically a royalty stream of cash that just flows from all the Dairy Queens that goes right to Omaha. Just an amazing, amazing buy.
How amazing. In the world did he find that?
is it an Omaha thing?
Was Dairy Queen an Omaha thing? No, yeah. I don't think so.
I don't see many of them out here.
They're out here.
Yeah.
In California, if you mean here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sort of. I mean, I just don't see them. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm on the protein.
No blizzards.
Oh man, they're so good though.
They are not too good for you, I don't think, but
The biggest sugar hit I get is when I'm sitting with you at Omaha at the meeting eating the C's for breakfast. Yeah.
And our friend Lonnie is force feeding you sugar like you were a duck that was going to be turned into foie gras.
Foie gras. We got in trouble for making a foie gras joke on this. Like we get it, we get in trouble occasionally for not just from like somebody was upset. Somebody was upset we made a joke about foie gras. If you're listening this far into the podcast, I apologize for the foie gras joke. If somehow you just found it by searching the internet, then go away.
If you mentioned it now, are we going to get demonetized? Because I was hoping to get paid. I was hoping to get paid from this appearance.
you get your 30 cents.
Awesome. I'm excited.
Well, can we talk about lag leaks now? Is that okay? Now that it's been
here we go.
Demonetized.
what was it? Sorry.
Oh, the COVID lab leak now being.
Oh, the lab leak. Yeah.
Now it's an okay thing to hypothesize, whereas before, if you even mentioned it,
that was verboten.
Canceled.
Yeah, you weren't allowed to say that. Also weren't allowed to suggest that the Ukraine was. You couldn't victim blame the Ukraine. So I got an early note about that early in the. Very early in the war.
What does that mean?
I don't know. I've never heard that expression in relation to a country before.
Like they were asking for it or something? Implying?
Yeah. But it was just a funny term. It was just a funny phrase. I just never heard that in relation to a country before. Yeah,
shouldn't have worn that that outfit out. You were asking
on the border. Yeah.
My shot at this 30 cents is going away very quickly.
I'm surprised we made it this far before we got canceled, honestly.
What do you think about it? If we have time real quick, what do you think about, for example, Geico, like something like that never being, I mean, I know he's discussed in the past, but especially on something where he could angle it more to what he's said and what he's thought, as opposed to calling out potentially, man, are you surprised ever that he doesn't really do that anymore? I mean, I know it's late in the game. He's done his time, but still.
What do you mean calling it out?
Just discussing, hey, I was even simple as I kind of was wrong on this and here's what's happening, just to give people an understanding of what even is going on to some extent.
I bet he'll talk about it this year. I bet it'll come up because it's kind of a fairly loud data point. Those were kind of awful results. So I wouldn't be surprised if it comes up and that he's pretty forthcoming with it and says that it was a mistake.
That's a tough business.
Well, they've been pretty quick to admit mistakes in the past, so it wouldn't surprise me. But I do think that you're right that there's certainly no real, like, his upside to downside on calling out like big problems even is relatively skewed to it's just not worth it at this stage for him. Like he's on a victory lap. Like it's all, he should just be positive all the way out and finish strong. And there's no reason to like go out on a cranky note necessarily. So I think the days of him really calling bullshit on stuff have kind of passed a little bit.
He took a shot on the buybacks.
That was like, that is the exception that proves the rule in my mind that like how rare it is anymore that he calls bullshit on stuff.
Buybacks. Yeah. And I guess so that's a theme.
I guess on Berkshire company specific stuff, that's probably kind of always been, it was more of a, it's more of a meeting discussion than really the, I mean, the letter was only for praise to the extent that it ever touched on that stuff, generally speaking. So I guess that's fair.
He's a big believer in that.
Praise in public. And
yeah, we'll put praise by name and criticize by category.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was hoping he could criticize himself since he was the one who said some of these things.
He does. He does. Yeah, I'm sure he will.
Yeah, yeah.
He took a shot at the last meeting when Munger was saying, Munger was criticizing someone, and he kind of said, hey, we don't criticize by name. He was like, he means it, even talking to his 98-year-old partner. Yeah. He's just like, hey, careful.
I still love you, Warren. I'm not criticizing you if you're still listening after those Ukraine comments.
he switched off at foie gras.
That got him, yeah.
Hey, thanks, Alex. Great episode today. Thanks, JT, yeah, as always.
Thanks, Alex.
Thank you.
We'll be back next week. Same bat channel, same bat time. See you, everybody.